Okay, this is part one for May 15th, 2006. This is the fourth session, so part one of the fourth session, and we're beginning with the issue of me saying that we're in a non-communicating world.
Right, okay.
No.
I think you used the word that we live in a post-communication world. And I was, although I kind of have a sense of what you're saying, I think that's kind of a hard concept to wrap your mind around, because naturally, you know, I might say, well, what do you mean? I turn on the TV or the radio and they're communicating to me, or I pick up the phone and I'm communicating to you. So where do you come in saying that we're in a post-communication world?
Right. You know, apparently, according to our literate history, people believed 1,000 years ago the world was flat. And the idea it was round was crazy. The popular word is counterintuitive. People intuited, or back then intuited, it was a flat world, and it was counter to that intuition that it was round, right?
Mm-hmm.
So this is a counterintuitive statement, that we live in a post-communication world. It's obviously absurd in relation to the common sense. But then we can look at what the word communication means. But without getting into the semantics of communication and what it means, is it just verbal, is it gestural, is it your clothing, is it your body odor and all that multi-level way of looking at communication. In the simple definition of what it is that since there's so much communication going on, interaction of different media and different forms of communication going on constantly, the ability to translate that into a coherent, transmittable piece of data, which most people call communication, it's usually considered one-on-one matching, one-on-one agreement, or an argument within agreed-upon context. So I'm saying that there is no matchable situation in all this communication. There's nothing to refer to for anybody to claim there is a context that everybody can understand when you have millions of cultures. And it is millions. I mean, there's only, say, 500 cultures in the world, but there's all kinds of subcultures in the TV body and the chip body. So we got a million cultures going on. A million, and a culture is a matrix of communication.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm saying the normal effect that people assume the word communication evokes is not happening.
Mm.
So that's what I mean by post-communication world.
So you're saying that there's a cultural scale, there's a lot of phatic gesturing going on and no language communication.
Okay,
of course, but we have to distinguish that from, like, for instance.
But let me correct you. Communication includes the phatic.
Uh-huh.
All right? Like I said, we could get into an argument about what is communication.
Right.
And I said there's the matching kind of communication, there's the gestural. Gestural is phatic. Now, I say that since in a post-communication world, the common denominator becomes the phatic. And that's a kind of bonding, but that was during the TV body era. We now are into a situation where the phatic doesn't even. And I actually brought up this point with Baudrillard when he spoke at Guggenheim, the museum, in November 25th, 1997. I was in the audience. And I said, are you talking about the phatic? And he says, no. And he knew what I meant by the phatic. He'd even used the term in his writings. He says, no, because that implies contact.
Mm-hmm.
You know, if I say how you doing and you say how you doing back to me, there's contact.
Yeah.
He's saying there's no contact. He's saying there's no communication going on.
Mm-hmm. On what level? You and I are matching with each other or we couldn't be having a dialogue. So what we're talking about sort of global communication network, which is not communicating?
Yes. There was a book came out in 1980 by George W.S. Trow, who wrote for National Lampoon, The Context of No Context. We have a context in an immediate situation, human scale, where we can talk. But we can't No one's hearing us. We don't know if we tape this, if it's going to mean anything to anybody. And there's all this other interaction going on, millions of phone calls, millions of TV show exchange, internet exchange. We're subatomic in relation to all the other stuff. And so what is the big context that our accumulation fits into? What are we useful for, if we think of you, one aspect of communication is usefulness?
Useful to who? The
yeah,
nature or cosmos?
Yeah. What are the different contexts? So that's the issue, is that this, we are matching, but we must, if we were two guys talking in a little village 1,000 years ago, and we were not in the field working, and we're off talking about metaphysics or whatever we would call it, guy at the plantation guy comes by and says, what are you guys doing? Get the hell out there, you know? And, you know, we're not working. They make us work. And we have to give up our talk. We would be noticed, and what our activity would communicate something to somebody, in this case, slacking off and not working, right?
Mm-hmm.
Remember the famous scene in The Life of Brian, where the centurion, the Roman warrior, comes walking by, and there's two sub-warriors sitting there talking philosophy, and as soon as the big guy, the boss, walks by, I guess they're called centurions, they start talking like retarded people. And they pretend they're just dumb guys, so the centurion doesn't take them seriously, moves on. Then they go back into this profound conversation. We don't have that policing us. We're in a little village. What we say and do might be noticeable, and people would react to it, positive or negative or indifferent. So I'm saying what we're doing is so puny because there's millions of people talking like this now. So,
because there's no objective measure by which to...
There's no context. And think of context as medium. There's no other communication matrix or medium that this fits into that we could claim it has influence.
Oh.
So, you know, what did I...
Of course, it was always true in the past, even before the electronic environment, that, you know, if somebody spoke French and somebody spoke... English or Chinese, and they met each other, you know, there was no communication because there was no context to...
Oh, no, there was the communication.
There was no Esperanto that could, you know...
But, Scott, there was the communication of them interacting with each other, and others could notice it.
Yeah.
Nobody's seeing us unless the NSA is tapping us and making something out of it.
Yeah, you saw in the paper the other day that they're accusing the present administration of recording every single phone call in a database over the last so many years.
Yeah, and that is not a problem as far as I'm concerned, because none of those phone calls mean anything to them unless it does mean something to them.
Yeah.
So they got.
Well, they have a watcher, which is some super meta program, which is, you know, filtering all these conversations for word content.
Yeah, and so it's like they are as puny as we are, but they have the public legacy of print matching state media, and they think they've got to be responsible for something, so they have to monitor everything to see what's out there in relation to their puny operation. They're as tiny as us. Now, it's not a controversial statement that requires much explanation. Sorry I made that. But the, so anyways, the idea we're a post-communication, it's a probe, it's a way to make you think, you know, think differently about what's going on and what your assumptions are.
Mm-hmm.
It is provable up to a point if you're willing to understand what I'm saying.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And this
sort of relates to
that's just you, Scott. I'm just talking about to you. I mean, I'll say it on the radio, I'll say it all the time, but I don't know who's hearing it, and I don't know who it affects, you know?
Yeah.
But if I was saying this in a town hall meeting, say I go to a small town hall meeting, and I'm a local person, and I start talking about a post communication, I'd have to really explain it, and probably it would be decided, well, that's got nothing to do with the taxes and the crime in our village that we got to deal with. You know what I mean?
Exactly.
And then I might say, well, maybe it does, because all these kids or the criminals are using all these invisible networks. As Bucky Fuller says, we've been in an invisible and inaudible world for most of the 20th century. That's right, invisible.
Who said that? Bucky Fuller?
Bucky Fuller. And inaudible. In other words, it's what McLuhan called neither eye or ear. It's something else. McLuhan called it tactile. Bucky Fuller didn't call it tactile. He called it basically thought, or the pattern integrity, or new technologies. But that's where we're at. But and that leads to a lot of new relationships between humans. It changes the way people communicate, traditionally by speech. So that when you talk about the couch potatoes watching TV most of their lives, doesn't mean they're not communicating. They're just not engaged in the verbal medium.
Mm-hmm.
And they're interacting with whatever television is showing them.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. But now you're saying it doesn't mean they're not communicating, so we can't say that they're in a post-communication world if we can.
Right. Oh, okay. They are communicating, but I was relating that to the put down that they're couch potatoes and that only when people use speech is that significant.
Mm-hmm.
And that's considered a logocentric view. You know, speech is the most important medium.
Mm-hmm.
Well, we're finding out that may not be the case. But that person can engage with television and is in an act of communication, but relating that to other contexts, there's no connection.
Mm-hmm.
And this is why McLuhan said there are no connections in matter. He also meant there are no connections between media. Back in the 50s, he had a little statement right in the middle of the explorations, one of the issues. He said, is anybody listening? And another way I bring it up is that the Android meme talks to its constituents, to its parts of itself, the other media, not to the chemical body.
Mm.
So there's different ways to look at the statement, we're not communicating. Certainly when you go on a news group, the ones I've been on, eventually people get pretty frustrated and they start insulting each other or getting edgy. Now, there's people who analyze why this is. It's like some people who are shy want to get aggressive. They can do it. No one knows who they are because they're under a pseudonym and all that stuff. But to me, the spamming or the trolling, these are terms they call that apply to news groups, they show how verbal and visual communication becomes destabilize when you're in the chip body, the discarnate state, and it's a mirror of the pretty hard to match when so many messages are being posted on the news group. People can pick different parts to respond to. It's like a microcosm of what's going on collectively through all the massive media environments. So the general statement about the 20th century is it's the most violent century of history, known history, right?
Mm-hmm.
The 20th century. And it's the century that's had the newest technological and communication environments. They brought in radio as, hey, this will help people communicate. Bring in TV, help people communicate. It actually creates a lot more violence in its effects. So that's a simple way to look at how communication is dead. Communication in the sense of achieving a sort of rational consensus or community agreement. That has always been upset by new media, especially in the 20th century. Didn't we talk in a previous session about Hieronymus Bosch?
Yeah.
He was painting the upset that the printing press was bringing in. That was just one new medium. Took another 300 years for other major media to come in. And when they did, you end up having the most violent century. So it's naive to think that communication and matching can happen in an environment with so much interesting interactive media going on. So you have to have another way of approaching communication.
Mm-hmm.
The notion of it and what you're trying to do. It's from all, I think that the reason cults happen more and more in the 20th century is that they're a way of instant retrieval of matching consensus or the old tribal needs of having a sense of community and where everybody kind of thinks alike.
Mm-hmm.
Cults fill that need.
Mm-hmm.
And they may look dangerous in relation to values, literate values, industrial values of individual freedom, individual expression and all that, and it just looks too much like a mass much like a mass mind, but when you it's retreating from a situation where there's no mass mind communicable in a shared image. So then what becomes the terms in the advertising world or commodity world is branding. And people adapt to a brand. So even consumption becomes cult-like behavior.
Mm-hmm.
So it's the, and that's a form of communication. But it's a form of communication that looks vulgar and dumbed down compared to the values of the 19th century when progress was the big meme and the idea of educating the citizen. So if you just think about it for a while, it's really easy to see that the statement that we live in a world that's non-communicating or a post-communication world makes sense if you think about it. Yeah. If you just take the meanings of communication different ways it's applied.
Yeah. Well, no matter how many cult group factions you get, whether they're large or tiny cults, one thing that coheres them is that they all pretty much have to live by the law of the land. Otherwise, you end up with a Waco situation. So there is an overarching kind of a set of rules.
That's the industrial society rules. And that's what the printing press brought in was humans equal under the law.
Mm-hmm.
That moved out of feudalism. So that began 400 years ago. Industrialism spread it. So the literate industrial kinetic media really made the law happen.
Mm-hmm.
And even that, when it was coming in, or made the law uniform in a major ground.
Yeah. And we can see what's happening to the law under electric conditions.
Right.
Even the Constitution is apparently being eroded and lost.
Well, let's go back to the 20s. The first, when radio came in, the Italian semi-literate, non-literate gangs coming from Sicily were able to take the new decentralized and chaotic cities under the effect of telephones, cars, movies, and radio to start organizing little secret cults or gangs and mafias. And they got an economic foothold. So the visual values, the literate values of following the law were vulnerable in the 20s. And it's just accelerated in all kinds of cults or mafias. The drug dealing expanded after World War II. And so when you talk about the Constitution being undermined today, that is not really what's being undermined today. We don't have a Constitution. That lost its power in the 20s because the mafias eventually became very powerful in the legislature.
Mm-hmm.
Right? And after Kennedy was assassinated, the mafias were in. They just expanded their business. To be in the mafia is a dangerous situation. You probably have a lifetime of 5 years, and then you're knocked off because of the competition or the anarchy within it. But it's just like a showbiz. Get a lot of money, get a lot of wealth, a lot of fame, a lot of drugs, sex, and rock and roll, and then you're gone in 5 years, you know, and you're a basket case. So to be a figure in this anarchistic media environment is a dangerous thing. If you care, a lot of humans, that's good enough. They'll go down in a nihilistic way because they want to get those secular pleasures, you know.
Mm-hmm.
So what the Constitution is being undermined, the invasion of privacy, it's already been a fact, since the 60s at least, with FBI surveillance, CIA domestic surveillance, even though they weren't allowed to. So what do you think you mean when you say something is being lost now?
Well, invasion of privacy is a big part of it. This, you know, we're seeing with the Homeland Security and the fear of people losing their sense of privacy with respect to their personal financial lives or their personal social lives, which they used to want to keep secret.
Let me try to refine that. Privacy was a product of literate industrial society. We haven't had privacy for most of the 20th century. What this new surveillance is, it is invading the non-private, discarnate, mobile autonomy that the post-satellite environment in the 60s created. People were able to do all kinds of things, and nobody knew they were doing them because they could get together by telephones and speed of cars and jet travel all around the world. So proliferation of all kinds of groups and different kinds of behavior. But it's that, it's the non-private, discarnate world that the chip body surveillance is threatening.
Mm-hmm.
What are they monitoring? Telephone calls and email and all that stuff. That's not privacy built on literacy. You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
That's autonomy built by the decentralized media of the middle 20th century.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think I mentioned to you that if it's true, and the documents that I looked at looked like they were being presented honestly, that Congress and Bush have signed into effect the National ID card to take effect 2008. The National ID card will have biometric data to identify the person who is associated with the card. Possibly there'll be a chip embed into the card with all the person's medical and other personal data logged in there. The cards could even be possibly tracked by satellite. When I told you all this, you didn't seem all that concerned about it.
No, I don't. And which brings up the other point I was trying to remember 10 minutes ago to begin this part. Talking about the fragmentation of media and non-communication, you know the cliche that only 27% of the Americans vote, and they're the ones that decide the outcome of the elections?
Mm-hmm.
You've heard that cliche.
Sure.
You know, one quarter, and then that's divided between two parties. So
yeah, and with the new electronic voting machines and no paper trail, we don't even know. It could be just a handful of people determining the election.
Okay, but this 25% is in the 90s, before we get to the voting machine problem. And so politics and the industrial bureaucracy that Congress represents and the president represents, that's a small medium compared to all the other media people live in and other environmental structures and economic means of livelihood. It's such a puny operation that it can just be involving one quarter of the American population. Okay, so that's politics. To bring in, what was the next thought? The voting machines. It seems that since most people are living a discarnate life the last 40 years and knew that they didn't need to worry about politicians in their own lives and they could do all kinds of business all over the world, without those strictures that were 100 years ago. Therefore, that majority of people's experience, it's that's coming in. And the voting machines are saying elections are obsolete. They're just a programmed environment. They're even more obsolete now in the 21st century. That industrial structure is even smaller. So why not just program it? Why not just have the Supreme Court select the person? That is why I'm slightly indifferent, because the values that, or the rights that people think are being threatened disappeared 80 years ago. So I'm saying what is being threatened is the TV discarnate body. The TV body, and it's a decentralized body, and all the analog media that go with it, is being threatened by the chip body. And I think that we're past the chip body, which is another level of the non-communication. The chip body is panicking, and it's invading the chip body to secure itself. So we're seeing the chip body panicking and surveilling everybody, trying to look busy, and that's because we've moved past even the chip body. We're now in the what I call the Paleolithic, small groups of people interacting and beating each other over the head.
Mm-hmm.
So that's a more dangerous or threatening situation than the loss of privacy.
So that's why. But that's talking on a grander scale than the small injustices of individuals using the chip body as a medium for spying on other individuals for their own nefarious purposes.
Well, that's been going on. So it's not covered in the media, but you could find all kinds of evidence of people whose lives have been really disrupted by the decentralized, invisible world we've been living in for 40 years.
Mm-hmm.
In so many ways, the injustices at the legal profession did, the medical profession, the sport profession. I mean, basically, the media byproduct of that is just total chaos and failure everywhere.
Yeah.
All right? I'd say that's the TV body world and then the early chip body world. So
there was an item in the news recently about a lawyer who teamed up with a technical guy who knew about telephone surveillance. The technical guy was able to tap the phones of the individuals that this lawyer was prosecuting, and so he was able to gain information. And these on big people, you know.
This was in L.A. That's that Anthony Pelicano case, or something.
Yeah.
Yeah.
This is a situation where a rogue individual, apart from the government, is taking advantage of the ability to do this.
And that's in all realms of life. That's why the dope mafias took over wherever they have influence. There's so much of that going on. It's like McLuhan said back in the 50s, we're now a mafia-ridden society in all forms, in the record industry, movie industry, in high schools. There's so much lack of control over the citizens and the discarnate people because there's no way to do it. We've got too much wealth going on, and people can organize in the invisible zones all the time.
Yeah. So I wonder if we can tie this back into last week's discussion on LaRouche, where LaRouche talked about Kepler, who had a holistic view of the harmony and beauty of the cosmos.
Yeah.
And but his scientists that he favored, like Kepler and so on, who had that vision, they did not rise to prominence. The oligarchy favored the scientists who had fragmented notions of the cosmos, which ended up giving us all fragmented, educating everyone to believe in a fragmented universe. And in a fragmented universe, nobody has any higher ideals. And
okay, hold it. Let me hold it, what you said. The fragmented universe that the printing press brought in was a novelty. It was great. It was a whole new way to organize information.
Mm-hmm.
And that was the point, is that it seemed to be important. And it did lead to what McLuhan called the monofracture by specialism that led to setting the industrial groundwork for the world we're in today, into the reintegrated world. So we had to go through the monofracture, fragmented part. It's just that when you bring in the reintegrated electronic analog world, which is holistic again, interconnects everybody, on a certain level, on other levels, it fragments tribal groups, but the interconnectedness, the electronic implosion, the problem is that people naturally will try to project the services of the previous industrial fragment environment, which were services at the time when it was invisible ground, are irrelevant when you're in electronic age.
Yeah.
So it's like we move from one era into another, one medium into another, and we go through collective death. And so when you die, if you believe in the Buddhism thing, you can't take your worldly attachments and the values you have when you go into the bardos. You got to be detached. You can't take your possessions with you. What people didn't know in the 20th century is that we bring in radio and TV, we cannot bring everything that we thought was valuable under 19th century conditions into the 20th century once we have these new environments.
Mm-hmm.
And that leads to the comedy and absurdity and the war and everything that happens.
Yeah.
And we've always gone into the future backwards. So you're only under the impact of the electronic integrated phase of the 20th century when you put down the fragmented world. You'll see in Gutenberg Galaxy, McLuhan goes around saying, look at all these guys touting holistic values in academia and different authors he cites. They're only doing it under the knee-jerk reflect of the electronic implosion. And they're just lashing out of previous values and not having an ecological view, realizing that the fragmented phase was important at the time that it was the hidden ground.
Yeah, but you got to fight for the new holistic phase to help bring... You want to see that dominate over the fragmented phase. So these guys aren't wasting their time and energy by promoting the holistic vision.
What guys?
The guys who, under the influence of the electronic age or knee-jerk reaction, are coming up with holistic visions.
Okay, I'm not sure I'm getting it. They are coming up with visions, but usually they're writers, and they're conceptualizing holism.
Oh.
And they don't understand... that they're just coming, just trying to change the old conceptual baggage of and reform the conceptual baggage of specialism and try to have an integrated vision. It's just like Einstein felt the need to upgrade Newton. Mm-hmm. And that was under the electronic impression, subconscious electronic media, just like Picasso felt that impressionism wasn't powerful anymore. The changes in the arts and sciences, sports, politics, and all the activities of the country or nation, you can see that the demand for new is due to a new medium coming in.
Mm-hmm.
And it's not the information transmitted on the medium, it's the sensory makeup of the medium itself.
Yeah.
So you were saying that these guys were trying to bring in, they were trying to bring a holistic thing, but they still were doing it in the old-fashioned way?
Well, no, you said that McLuhan kind of put them down as being reactionary. They're just reacting to the new electronic environment by coming up with holistic concepts. And
concepts, that's right.
That's,
they were reacting to the content.
Yeah, that's a
kind of content.
Puny somnambulistic effort. But
right.
If we stay fragmented, we're going to kill ourselves. So we got to have people who are coming up with holistic visions, even if it's just a...
No, we don't need people with holistic visions. We need people to look at what is actually causing the new environment. And
right.
You just look at the medium
yeah.
and its characteristics.
Yeah.
It's very simple.
Yeah, and that's where McLuhan felt that we needed to look at orchestrating the forms of media. Or
yeah, the
yeah.
forms, the structures.
Yeah.
And that was a simple idea, but... In the period of the 1560s, it just was way beyond anybody's ken.
Still is. I don't hear anybody talking about it outside of you and whatever your circle of friends are.
Yeah, the thing is, what I'm saying is that the services of the integrated lifestyle, the new tribalism, the new mass man, which is not tribalism but autonomous man, they were too great to stop.
Yeah.
Just like the specialist effect of 200 years ago was too great to stop.
Yeah.
But if you get run over in the process and you wonder what happened, then you go and McLuhan gives you the diagnosis.
Yeah.
He tells you, well, this is why what happened to you happened.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But the economics of the situation are always going to be the driving force in the electronic
age. Economics were completely changed after World War II.
Yeah.
Everything was based on the credit card and debt.
Yeah.
Keynesian economics. That was outrageous to people, say, at the end of the 19th century, first part of the 20th century.
Yeah.
So the radio environment brought in a new kind of economics.
Yeah.
The digital environment is looking for a new kind of economics. Keynesian economics collapsed, and then you brought in Friedmanites and the supply-siders and privatization. All privatization was just the economic principle applied to a decentralized, autonomous situation where everybody was like an astronaut rotating around all the media. As we became more digitalized, beginning with the instant replay and the Walkman
mm-hmm.
and the VCR.
Mm-hmm.
So privatization changed economics, and a lot of people say it was good for the economy. A lot of people say, no, it wasn't.
Mm-hmm.
But they're only talking about the particular human response to the situation and the triumphs and disasters. And for most of the world, it's been a disaster because their economies have evaporated. Third world countries were doing okay in the 1560s. Basket cases by the 80s. That's because of the digitalization of the economy and the privatization. So if we want to take a serious look at why that happened, you look at the media. You don't look at television. You don't look at computers. You look at the effect of a digital situation, which was the new media,
mm-hmm.
what I call the Android meme.
Mm-hmm.
And now...
I'm not sure what you're saying by privatization, because obviously that happened back in the visual space era. There was privatization during the electronic era, and now there's privatization during the digital era, so I'm not sure what distinction you're making there.
Well, each era had a different meaning for privatization. The privatization of the digital era was education based on vouchers. No more mass Medicare. Have the, what do you call Kaiser and those guys? I don't do it.
Oh, yeah, HMOs.
Yeah, HMO took over. And you had privatization in terms of Wall Street tycoons coming in and buying up a factory or taking over his debt, firing everybody, and then making it profitable and then moving on. Think of privatization in the digital era as Rumpelstiltskins, people flying in from other zones and clamping on a local community and its struggling plant and firing everybody, irregardless of the effect on the community, and then redoing something to the plant, and then usually get it going. and then move on to another company.
Yeah.
So that's a different privatization than the privatization of 200 years ago, where people had the right to read by themselves or get educated by study in a school, right?
Yeah.
So you take any theme or concept like privatization, and you see it changes its meanings as the media changes.
Right.
So yes, so there's three different meanings of privatization there.
Yeah.
Just as McLuhan would say that to be cool was different, had a different meaning in the 20s than it did in the 50s or 60s.
Mm-hmm.
Cool meant in the 20s to be detached and disinterested. Now that's partly the detachment of the visual man, right?
Mm-hmm.
The eye man.
Yeah.
And it became, as you get swallowed up in the radio environment of the 20s, the previous stance of detachment caused by literacy became archetypalized as a huge value. But it couldn't stay, and so by the 50s, the new cool was a postural body language response to the information environment. So you had the Beatnik form of cool, you had the Miles Davis form of cool, you had the teenager form of cool. It was not something about being detached. Basically, it was in sync with
in
rhythm.
Yeah, and by the time we get to the 60s with groovy, you're in the groove, then you're really in the flow, and
now
that's cool.
What was the last word?
And that's cool, being in the flow.
Yeah, and I don't know what the words were in the 70s and 80s, but what was really important to me was the word fat in the early 90s, P-H-A-T.
Yeah.
It became a meme in American hip-hop culture in 92, right when my book came out. I didn't even know about it. But when I got here in New York in 93, there was this company called Fat Farm. It was Fat Farm. I think it was maybe Richard Simmons, that guy Simmons, one of the heavy hip-hop moguls. He came up selling clothes, and he called it Fat, P-H-A-T. Where'd that come from? Well, I found out that fat meant groovy to these young kids. Well, what 60s people meant cool or groovy, that's what they meant by fat.
Yeah, resonates the phatic.
Right, and so the kids again came up with something responding to the new rhythms, and we'd moved into a phatic society, which is everybody off in their own little universe, each media in their own little universe, carving out their own spaces, and to keep a general level of public coherence or TV body coherence, an image of it, everybody would be phatic with each other. So more and more interviews on TV, the Katie Couric world, the Good Morning America, it was a lot of phatic schmoozing, is another word that relates to that. Phatic schmoozing while the business of selling your commodity got on the air.
Mm-hmm.
So we became a phatic society as a form of politeness.
Yeah.
It's like the turning Japanese, as the talking heads, or whoever it was, maybe it was not the talking heads, whoever sang turning Japanese. The point was the decorum of public life in Japan was being forced on the individualistic West in America. And so the term was fat.
So what do you see as the happening to privatization in the coming era of cold fusion hardware?
I think cold fusion will it'll create super privatization, but it'll also allow people to form new communities and based around weird phenomena.
Mm-hmm.
With the more option to leave. It just will create a situation of total individual freedom and collective getting together freedom that has been happening in the 20th century, but under the duress of money.
It put the cult vibe into hyperdrive.
Yes, but it'll be a cult of art form. It'll be done as a put-on.
Yeah. If people reach that collective understanding that everything's disappeared, and
no, not everything disappears. Everything reappears under cold fusion, because you don't have the control of rent.
Mm-hmm.
You've got your battery. You don't need to pay for anything. You've got your security.
Yeah.
So, privatization or forming communities under the stress of disappearing money in the 20th century. Money's not an issue when you have social life after cold fusion. I'm not sure what kind of social forms will show up, but basically, if you don't have the stress of rent, then people have the time to commune, to get together, and to organize whatever values and products they'll organize different media.
Right.
Around, people have shared the situation, but there'll be no pressure on them.
So Marxism and capitalism and all these isms will become obsolete. It'll be something new.
Yeah, it'll be more subsets. There'll be, you know, lesbian, Spanish, vegetarians get together. They got their batteries. They got their basic energy needs met. So they get together and grow vegetables and concentrate on that kind of food.
And government, will there be an overarching mass media, word makes the market type operation going on, do you think?
Only on an administrative level. Like the world government will come in, but it'll just be logistics of making the hardware be distributed more efficiently.
Yes, assuming the people running the new world, the world government are not going to be mafiosa minded type individuals.
Well, there'll be probably zones where people who want to kill each other can get together. Mm-hmm. So it could be totally anarchistic. It could be nihilistic. It could be anything, but it can also be different and better than what was.
Yeah.
The basic pressure.
See, when people are left alone and they have enough to meet their basic needs, I think violence goes way down. I think when people are overcrowded into slum situations and they can't get their needs met, then violence goes way up.
Right, but
you're talking about a situation where people are going to get their needs met.
It's almost like everybody will go into the little matrix bubble, voluntaristically. The Matrix movie shows everybody under duress inside their bubble. Now you'll be able to spend your time. So crime, violence could come in when there's boredom. So probably they'll keep the standard national word makes the market thing going to give a sense of public order and stop the boredom or have a tension that you bounce off of. But basically, cold fusion, as it shows in my chart, that immeasurable ... line, it moves into the totally unfamiliar. We don't know what it'll be like.
Yeah. You know, if everyone around the planet's able to get their needs met and have a reasonable sense of their energy needs, their housing security, and so on, it's going to break down the economic divisions, and probably we won't even need borders anymore. I mean, the whole reason of having borders are to keep less economically developed countries from invading more economically developed countries and so on. But if everyone can be happy where they are, there won't even be a need for borders.
Yeah, but they'll be mobile through digital media. They'll be talking to anybody.
Yeah, well, we've already lost those borders. I mean, those borders are gone.
Right, so the world government will come in and pick up the rear guard action of organizing a borderless world for industrial hardware, industrial media, making that distribution more efficient. But then, oil tankers will be obsolete, so they'll move into chemistry, which they've already done. So all kinds of
people will go start cult communities on old oil tankers and live at sea.
Yeah, so it'll be, in one way, you could see people will be living in a world of constant theatrical happenings.
Yeah.
But there'll be always those that will be overdone by that, exhausted by it, and have an identity threat and move on to something else. So it will be what people have always been doing, but a totally new, unfamiliar context. So in the long run, starvation will go, disease will go, the whole utopian vision for the chemical body will be realized.
Yeah.
But everybody will be juggling their chip and TV and whatever other media, communication matrix kind of media coming. They'll be really involved in games and sports and tensions involving expressing themselves.
Yeah. Well, you know what's going to take a long time to happen is for religious idealism to equalize to where these fundamentalists all respect one another, see each other's religious views as being non-threatening and so on. That fighting is going to probably be going on for a long time.
Well, yeah, but it's not the fundamentalist's fault. It's the astral body's fault. The need to find something transcendent.
Yeah.
Someone puts their identity, sews their identity on. So that's the fundamentalists. They'll just be one faction marketing themselves for community, and there's no better religion than them, and there's no less religion than them. They're just another religion. So the religious impulse will be interacting with the showbiz religious, those that worship centralized showbiz media personalities.
Mm-hmm.
That's a modern form of religion.
Oh, yeah. Well, a lot of these fundamentalist guys actually become show business guys, celebrities.
Yeah. So the fundies, there's going to be tension between those that want to keep the values eternal, the ones that we inherited, and there's the others that are going to believe that reality changes and put a value on that.
Mm-hmm.
So the ones who want to maintain a continuity will have a crisis with the, will have struggles with those that believe in flexibility. Neither is, you could say, right, but seeing that drama would be a healthy view.
Mm-hmm.
But most people are not in a position to see the detached, harmonious view from the mountain. They're engaged.
Yeah.
They're in a struggle for identity. And identity is a product of violence. You get your identity through violence.
Yeah, you have to separate yourself from the other. And that's kind of a violent act.
Yeah.
Subtle violence.
The simple action of perception, which I call the drama of cognition between blocking and merging,
mm-hmm.
is a kind of energetic violent act.
Yeah.
So let's go into a quote. We've been...
Yeah, back to the book.
Yeah.
So everything we've been saying has been kind of a prelude leading up to McLuhan, which is our next page five. We're moving from LaRouche to McLuhan. And
the first quote is from...
I'm going to flip the tape and we'll start that on the next side because we've only got